Well, welcome back as we head into hour two, 602-508-0960. Two lovely things at the University of North Carolina. The protesters have taken down the American flag and hoisted on the main flagpole there. They have hoisted the Palestinian flag. It's funny. Who's got to keep my scorecard straight? Who's accused of dual loyalty in this country again? And this is lovely. At University of Wisconsin-Madison, coming from the Wisconsin Law Journal, Madison protesters shouted Heil Hitler at the University of Wisconsin's Jewish students while pitching tents on university grounds. The protesters were filmed chanting, "There is only one solution." Wow. One solution, and Heil Hitler. Good work. Good work, all. All right. We were asking earlier what the best pick for Donald Trump would be in his vice presidential selection. I know a lot of other shows have asked the audience about it. I have not. And what made me think of it was a piece of audio I was playing from Ron DeSantis in the last hour on how he deals with campus protesters and rioters, or how they do it in the state of Florida. And there is more and more talk, more and more writing, more and more chatter about Ron DeSantis potentially being a Donald Trump vice presidential pick. And I wonder what y'all think of that. I remember early on in the fight between the two, many were saying, oh, I just wish they'd get past this and just have a united ticket. And the fight got worse, and you started hearing a little bit less of that. I wonder if you think it's still a wise ticket, or if there's someone better that you would recommend. In any event, who should Trump pick? Jake is in Gilbert. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Seth. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So, this by saying I'm voting for Donald Trump no matter who his VP pick is, but that's more out of a sense of duty and logical reasoning that is better than any Democrat.
Yep.
But if Trump were to pick Governor DeSantis, that would get me emotionally invested. That would get me excited.
You like DeSantis.
And I think so much of what's out of whack today in our country stems from the COVID era. I think I've heard you say that. It seems to be that around that time, the earth tilted off its... And so much of our problems stem from that. It's maddening whenever I think about it. But Governor DeSantis was the man during that. He was like the voice of sanity who we could look to and think, oh, someone understands how tyrannical to COVID.
Yeah.
And I know that was 4 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was 4 years ago. But one sense is that is something that runs deep within DeSantis's character or constitution. I said in the last hour, and I should have said in introducing your call, one of the things I'm looking for is not someone who can represent a certain state or can appease a certain constituency so much as someone who can continue the revolution, if you will, someone who can carry forward after Trump's final term the agenda of the Republican Party or the conservative movement of the Republican Party. Donald Trump only has 4 years, and it's not hardly enough to fix what needs fixing. And that's even assuming majorities in the House and Senate, which is not an assumption that is safely made. So who would be the great, the great next guy or gal, right, who can carry forward and keep doing for another 4 or another 8 years what needs to be done? I'm perfectly fine with DeSantis. I think DeSantis has the intellectual metal. I think he has. Has he ever said anything I disagree with public policy wise? I can't think of what it would be. And as a governor, he's got the record to show it, right?
Right. And you're talking about how he's dealing with these campus protesters.
Yeah.
He's got the fight in him, and the same way he did during COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. No. The guy has. What was it said about Andrew Jackson? I have to pronounce this very carefully because I said this once at a forum and all the panelists looked at me. I know I said it right. They didn't hear it right. So let me say what was once said about Andrew Jackson, and let me say it very clearly. he has shoot in his eye. You know, he has shoot in his eye. You don't want to get into a public policy or debating contest with Ron DeSantis. He'll take you down. He's really good. And, you know, we could use some of that. We could use some of that. We could use a lot more of that. We could use some Ulysses Grant. We could use some Andrew Jackson. We could use some Donald Trump. We could use some Ron DeSantis. Anyway, any other thoughts? We're here for that. 602-508-0960. You see what I'm talking about? The protests and riots allowing them, the administrators and the local communities allowing them to continue. They go further and further down the drain in to the sewer of conversation. That's what happens when you continue an endless stinkhole into the sewer. That's where it goes, the sewer. And so you're now, you know, what was once, no, we're just fighting for Palestinian, we're just arguing for Palestinian human rights, has now morphed into, well, at the University of Wisconsin, Heil Hitler. At Columbia, Zionists should not be allowed to live. Or every protest, Israel should not exist. These are incantations to genocide. You know damn well, and this is the thing that I don't know why more people aren't thinking about this, but you know damn well, if you had right-wing protesters saying things half as noxious, half. I mean, just if they took over campuses and created tent cities and took over buildings and hoisted flags, the Gadsden flag, let us say, or the Confederate flag, let us say, or even just Donald Trump for president flags, let us say, this thing would not be a four-month story. It wouldn't be the three-week story that we've seen for the last fortnight and a half. It would be a one-day story because no one would tolerate it. No one would tolerate it. But here we have a situation where the faculty and the administration don't know how to handle it. And they don't know how to handle it because their sympathies run with the protesters. On the one hand, their sympathies run with the protesters and rioters, even though they know that the protesters and rioters are acting illegally, and that they are diminishing the currency of the value of the degree from that university by looking so damn asinine. I mean, there are literally graduates of places like NYU and Columbia who are ashamed to say that's where they went to college as a result of what these things have become. This is really self-destruction of these universities. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing that we are finally able to see in the clear of day what these places really stand for, what these places really teach. It wasn't enough, I suppose, for Alan Bloom to write his bestseller, The Closing of the American Mind, in 1987. It wasn't, I suppose, enough for Dinesh D'Souza to write his book, Illiberal Education, in 1991, let us say. It wasn't enough for all these other books that have followed in their paths. It wasn't enough for us to give speeches in defense of Western civilization and the Western canon. No one paid attention. They thought it wouldn't matter. Well, this is what you get in its absence. This is what you get in the absence of serious education that is adjoined to serious teaching. This is what you get. You get the rule of the mob with mob thinking and junk thought. And the Democratic Party is going to have a huge problem with this going forward because they don't know what to do about it either. They know Americans don't like what they're seeing. They know that. But about, my guess, half of the Democratic Party, if not a bit more, sympathizes with where these protesters and rioters are. I'm not saying they're sympathizing with Heil Hitler, but they're sympathizing with everything that got us to Heil Hitler, as you're now seeing at the University of Wisconsin. And they have no compunction whatsoever and cared not one whit about the call of Palestine from the river to the sea. That means no Israel. They didn't care. Now they're at Heil Hitler. At what point do they step in and say, we've got a civilization to actually protect here, and it seems like we're right now in the business of the abuse of civilization. 602-508-0960. Be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Here's what not to do. Fox News is reporting that Northwestern University has reached a negotiated settlement with protesters to include a committee to consider divesting from Israel and special housing for Muslim students, in addition to other concessions. As Matt Whitlock put it, this is literally negotiating with terrorists, and it will not end well for anyone. But the Democratic Party, as I was saying, has a big problem. They have a big problem. Charles Lipson, professor, not the same spelling, not the same, not related to me, professor at University of Chicago, writes that higher education is sinking lower and lower, and that's bad news for our country, which has benefited enormously from having the world's best system of higher education. It's bad news for Democrats, who face a tight election. Their party is closely tied to education at all levels, especially at elite universities. It is the party of experts, after all, and the party of the left. Universities are both. Moreover, since the Democrats control the executive branch, the public holds them primarily accountable for ensuring social order. Their failures are obvious to the average voter. That's bound to hurt Democratic Party candidates in November. Parents with children in college or expected to matriculate soon have every right to expect their children can learn in peace, hear diverse viewpoints, and speak freely without threats, intimidation, or indoctrination. That's true whether the parents are Jewish or not. Decent Americans won't tolerate threats against Jewish students any more than they would tolerate them against blacks, Muslims, Christians, or Asian Americans. Yet they now see those threats against Jewish students every day, and at many universities, they don't see administrators standing up for their rights. Parents don't understand why their kids aren't being protected. They are unhappy that classes have been canceled and graduation ceremonies relegated to Zoom. They are dismayed that their tax money is being flushed down a sinkhole of anti-American propaganda. They wonder what in the world has happened to once respected institutions, and it's a good question. One, the first and most obvious answer is that both Democrats and universities are seen as ideological soulmates. That association is particularly prominent in Ivy League schools, Stanford and flagship state universities such as the University of Michigan and the University of Texas. It is pervasive in the humanities division at every school, from Princeton to Northeast Podunk State. You are as likely to find a Republican professor of English as a Republican employee at NPR. If faculty members kept their lockstep ideological fervor to themselves, their courses would be properly insulated from partisan politics, but they aren't. In fact, faculty are happy to proclaim their views in class and, worse, to insist their students fall in line. Many professors are proud ideologues, intolerant of other views. Some are outright propagandists. They expect students to parrot those views or pay the price. That's wrong. It's a betrayal of what higher education should be. The public can now see this bias thanks to campus demonstrations. They can see the pernicious effects of identity politics, dividing the world into oppressed who are deemed righteous and the oppressors who are deemed guilty, based solely on their identity. They can see the sneering contempt for alternative views or even common sense. Two, Democrats cannot escape the association now that it has turned toxic. That's true even though most mainstream Democrats are appalled by violence and intolerance they see on campus. Yet they are inextricably linked to it in the public mind with no easy escape. Trying to sever that link entails serious political risks. Part come from deepening the split between mainstream politicians and the party's left wing on Capitol Hill, led by the Progressive Caucus and the Squad. It's a misnomer to call those hard left representatives progressive, however. What's progressive about supporting students who wave Hamas flags and march through the library shouting anti-Semitic slogans? How is that progressivism? They are rightly called the far left. They may be a relatively small group in Congress, but they carry disproportionate weight, just as the right does among Republicans. Remember how Matt Gaetz led a small band to oust Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and now Marjorie Taylor Greene and two or three others threaten Mike Johnson? Both right and left have the same source of leverage. When the Congress and the country are as closely divided as they are, then any small cohesive group can threaten the majoritarian control. They can do it in Congress and they can do it in swing states. For Democratic Party leaders, the far left presents a serious problem, and party leaders know it. They understand how much the campus demonstrations and open sympathy for terrorists hurt them. Decency demands that they denounce the intimidation, violence, and sympathy for terrorists in forthright terms without adding some tepid statement about moral equivalence, as Joe Biden did in his last public comment. Why so mealy-mouthed? Because moral clarity might cost them hotly contested swing states. The electoral risk doesn't come from disaffected Muslim voters. It comes from young voters who have moved much further left than their parents. The squad is their bullhorn in Congress. The shift among younger voters shows up in poll after poll. According to a recent Pew survey, 33% of younger Americans, that is to say ages 18 to 29, sympathize more with the Gazans than the Israelis. Support for Israel increases steadily by age bracket. Among Americans over 65, for instance, 47% sympathize more with Israelis and 9% with Gazans. The difference between parties is stark. Among younger people who lean Republican, sympathy for Israelis is more than twice as high as that for Palestinians. Among Republicans over 50-year-olds, only 3% sympathize more with Palestinians. Not so with Democrats. Younger ones overwhelmingly favor the Palestinians. Only 7% with Israelis. These numbers pose hard choices for the Democratic Party leaders who are trying to do their best to evade them. The outcome of the presidential election could hinge on a relatively small number of Arab American voters in Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, and younger voters in seven swing states. They might not be willing to vote for Trump, but they could support a third party candidate or refuse to go to the polls. Either choice could spell doom for Biden and some Senate candidates. Jill Stein just burnished her credentials with those constituencies by getting arrested at a pro-Palestinian event. Cornel West cannot possibly be far behind. Democrats don't have a solution for this problem, which pits the center-left plus independents against the far-left plus Arab Americans. That cleavage is the ballot box equivalent of the 7-10 split in bowling. The more you target the 7, the less likely you are to make 10, and vice versa. The more Democrats move to the center to assuage median voters, the more they alienate younger ones on the left and Arab Americans. Third, the president's efforts to appeal to younger voters by forgiving student loans links the party even more tightly to universities at a time when many voters are disgusted by those institutions. The problem goes beyond Joe Biden blatantly ignoring Supreme Court rulings on student loans, concerning as that contempt for our constitutional order is. He surely knows his policy will be smacked down once again by the courts. His goal, however, is not to provide genuine debt relief, but to show students and indebted graduates that he really, really supports them and Republicans really, really don't. Biden's aim is to convey that message and get past November before the courts overturn his giveaway. Fourth, the voters can see how identity violence and disruptions are treated in blue states and blue cities by Soros DAs and attorneys general. Let me come back on that point when we come right back. Seth Leibson here from my friends from the Midas Gold Group War Room. The MAGA veterans at Midas point out that the Federal Reserve note does not belong to you. It belongs to the Federal Reserve Bank. While the federal debt doesn't belong to the Federal Reserve Bank, that belongs to you. This is your wake-up call to what the Midas Gold Group veterans believe the central bank and government are trying to do, a controlled demolition of our current system with a central bank digital currency to take complete and utter control of our transactional freedoms. Protect yourself. Turn this wake-up call into a phone call to veteran-owned Midas Gold Group at 480-360-3000 or go to MidasGoldGroup.com. 480-360-3000 or MidasGoldGroup.com. Always faithful, Midas Gold Group. MAGA and proud of it. MidasGoldGroup.com. Our good friend Mark comes in with our weekly vocabulary from last week. Plebiscite, salubrity, argumentum ad misericordium, reverse Mondegreen, neologism, prattle, asymptotic, revanchism, antediluvian, purblind, prudential judgment, sepulchral, or sepulchral, contumacy, fracture the inference, and elucidate the propensity. You get that last one, don't you, young David? You get elucidate the propensity. That one goes to you for remembering that. I like that. Well done, Mark. Well done, young David. And thank you for that. I'm maddened, of course, by this administration at almost every level. There's no one more maddening to me than the face and voice of the administration, which is Karine Jean-Pierre, who might go down in history as maybe the worst or second worst press secretary for the White House in history. She's just a vacuous, empty suit, and gets away with this kind of thing. Bear with.
Here's another topic, and following up on what you said earlier about the protests in Colombia. Earlier you talked about how you didn't want to comment on what school administrators might do, but the protesters themselves have now defied that 2 p.m. deadline. Should they leave?
The protesters themselves have?
Yes, there was a deadline for them to leave by 2 p.m., and they have not done so. What does the White House think?
You mean that Colombia has said there is a 2 p.m. deadline for them? Okay. I'm just not going to comment on leadership at colleges and universities, their decisions. That's for them to decide. We've been very clear. Americans have the right to peacefully protest, and we're going to continue to call out any type of hateful rhetoric, any type of potential hateful violence here. It has no place in America. Anti-Semitism, we're going to call out. It is abhorrent, and that is hate speech. We're just going to be consistent. When it comes to those types of decisions on campuses, that is something for college, universities, leadership to decide on.
Okay, a few things. First of all, can anyone tell me an instance where they can recall Joe Biden or anyone in the administration calling out the anti-Semitism or the Jew hatred that has been documented and evidenced for the past several weeks? Can one? She says we're going to continue to, and we've been very clear. She loves saying we've been very clear. When she says we've been very clear, she means the opposite. She's just trying to get through the question and through a day. That's all she's trying to do. Also, I'm just not going to comment on. Why does she get to say that? I'm just not going to comment on. Why? Why does she get to decide what they're going to comment on or not? What is the point of a press conference? You can only ask questions about certain things. It would be nice to know where the White House stands. By the way, this is not just a matter of private concern. Federal dollars go to all of these schools. Federal dollars in research, federal dollars in student aid, federal dollars in grants, a lot of them. That is not the end of the story either. Title VI governs each and every, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act governs each and every university that takes student aid. Each and every one of them. And they are prohibited from allowing and tolerating this kind of behavior. False arrest, calls to genocide, racist bigotry. All of that is forbidden under Title VI. All of it. And schools can and should lose their funds or be sued for it. Who does that? The Department of Justice. Who's the Department of Justice? The administration. This idea that she has nothing to say and the administration has nothing to say and this is just a matter between the administration and the students is an ignorance of the law, if not a betrayal of it. But I hand you the Biden administration. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. In regard to Karine Jean-Pierre's tenure and her continual existence, you would think that when you have an administration so saddled by the inability to articulate clearly on anything. You have the vice president who's off doing God knows what, mostly known for her nonsensical, fabulous, new age gobblespeak and cackling. On the one hand, you have a president who can't get through a single sentence and who walks away in the middle of people talking to him and confuses countries and countries' leaders. You would at least think you might want to instill some confidence to the American people with an articulate or smart public face and voice of the White House, like a press secretary. You don't have it with Karine Jean-Pierre. And this is a great story, a greatly interesting story to me, at least. This is from Fox News earlier.
We can ask.
Jackie, did it catch you totally by surprise that this coup attempt by KJP was reported? And because they have great detail, they even talked about a job that she was going to get and how to exit. And the critiques they had on her seemed pretty much the consistent critiques about her. Doesn't understand the policy, glued to the binder, has to read everything verbatim. So it seems like there's a lot of substance to it. Did it catch you by surprise?
The story is that there is an effort inside the White House to find an exit, a soft ramp, a soft landing, an easy ramp and a soft landing for Karine Jean-Pierre to go somewhere else.
Well, it caught me by surprise, the timing of this report, because the whole Emily's List offer was several months ago. That right. was reported at the time. So I don't know what sort of made this come out now. Broadly speaking, you know, Karine has her wheelhouse in certain areas, just like we see John Kirby always talking about anything with national security, foreign policy, you know, former Pentagon spokesman. They sort of divide that job in that area. And when Karine has to, you know, talk about the things that usually John Kirby talks about, right. it's not as strong is when she talks about things that are more in her wheelhouse, political messaging, for instance. But the timing of the report was a little bit surprising because we knew about the Emily's List offer back in, I think, December.
Well, maybe it had to do with the fact that it came in, I think, on Friday. Saturday was the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You were up on the dais because you're part of the association and you're one of the officers. I'm sure that there was some small talk about that. It actually, at that event, I was there. A White House official, a very high-ranking person, told me that the story was absolutely true. They would like her to step aside, but she just won't go.
That's interesting. I mean, you see the on-the-record right. vehement denials that were in that New York Post report and then also echoed when we asked about it at Fox News. You know, behind the scenes, I think people speak a little bit more candidly, but I can't speak to right. it. Personally, I was, you know, on an island away from everyone else. So the only person I talked to all night was Doug Emhoff. And actually, he was a pleasure to speak to.
So in any event, Mr. Ducey is saying that it is spoken about quite routinely in the White House that they are doing everything they can to get rid of Karine Jean-Pierre. But she won't go. Marvin K. Mooney, will you please go now? She won't leave. Yes, young David.
All I can say is I bet John Kirby is licking his lips
yeah,
right now.
Yeah.
Salivating in the corner.
Yeah. Well, he's very good, actually.
He already practically does the job.
I know. You ever see him go on Fox? He goes on all the time. He's not afraid. And he doesn't score points necessarily, but, you know, he gives you some sense of confidence. Isn't he a former admiral in the Navy, too,
mm-hmm.
I believe? And I... But they will never replace her with him, just as they cannot replace Kamala Harris, just as they cannot easily get rid of, could not easily get rid of Claudine Gay, just as they cannot get rid of the president of Colombia. Because they made a bed on a bet that a lot of people told them was a really bad bet, but they didn't care. And that bet was... anyone can do any job. And what we're going to show you and what we're going to do differently here is we're going to hire, not by proven abilities to do the job or some facsimile of it in the past, but based merely on your gender or skin color or national ethnicity, as is the case with Colombia. With Colombia. And I think they're doing terrible damage. They did it with the vice president. They're doing it with Karine Jean-Pierre. These are not anywhere near the most qualified people. They're not anywhere near the middle level of qualified people for these jobs. Not anywhere near it. The president of Colombia has one publication to her name from 1994, and it looks to be plagiarized. One. That's it. Now, not all university presidents have to be academic stars. There's a model of a university president being, you know, a person of great stature who's not necessarily intellectually respected in his discipline. One thinks of Oh, heck, Dwight Eisenhower. He's a former president of Colombia, isn't he, young David, if I'm not mistaken? Yes,
yeah.
I am right. And sometimes you get people like that. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you get people like Larry Summers, who are a little bit of both. But they've made this effort to make them, you know, intellectual captains of their industry. And they're anything but. They're anything but. And I guess the most difficult thing to say about all this is the most honest truth about all this, which is when it's your color or your gender or your national origin that is your qualification, that is what gets you the job, and then you fail at that job or fail spectacularly or miserably, what is there to blame? What is there to blame? If it's your color or gender that got it for you, what is the message being communicated when you can't do it? That's the ultimate problem Shelby Steele wrote about in his classic book, The Content of Our Character. He said the ultimate crime of these race-based preferences is they create the, his phrase, quoting directly, powerful phrase, the permanent stigma of questionable competence. So people who happen to share the skin color, like, Glenn Lowry, professor at Brown, is hugely resentful because he thinks now his qualifications and abilities are questioned when he can play on any field. He's as good as they get. He's as good as any economist, any social economist has ever been. And yet he's constantly under the suspicion, he says, of having questionable competence and getting the job by dint of his skin color. When you keep doing what the Democratic Party and the liberal left is doing here with affirmative action, race-based and gender-based affirmative action, putting unqualified people in where their only qualification really is their immutable characteristic, you're going to create more division, you're going to create more racialism, and you might even be creating more racism. It's an awful thing they've done with this bad business, and it is a bad business. It is an ugly business. To think that race or gender determines thought is ugly. Do you trust this economy? How about a secure investment that actually helps people? YRefi has that. With YRefi, you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. With YRefi, you are in control. You can take income or not. You can compound it, whatever you like. And with YRefi, there are absolutely no fees. With YRefi, you can have peace of mind. There is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. And with YRefi, of course, you get a monthly statement and no surprises in it. YRefi offers up the secure collateralized portfolio investment opportunity where it may just be a better option for you than where you have some of your money now. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then R-E-F-Y.com, or call them at 888-YRefi24. 888-YRefi24. One of the sayings around here is make Orwell fiction again, M-O-F-A. How about make America normal again? Mana. What did Lincoln say about America? Almost blessed country? Blessed country? You think about these universities and how far they've moved. You think about, you just listen to these professors they interview. Never mind the students. Listen to the professors, the adults. I don't know. I used to call them learned ignoramuses because they were smart in one area and just ignoramuses on almost everything else. I'm not even sure if the learned part is accurate anymore because we now have a generation of professors who went through studying with learned ignoramuses. And they picked up the ignoramus part. They didn't pick up the learning part. And it's a sad thing to see when you think about all of this. Leo Strauss said liberal education, which consists in the constant intercourse with great minds, is a training in the highest form of modesty, not to say of humility. It is at the same time a training in boldness in that it demands from us the complete break with the noise, the rush, the thoughtlessness, the cheapness of the Vanity Fair, of the intellectuals, as well as of their enemies. It demands from us the boldness implied in the resolve to regard the accepted views as mere opinions, or to regard the average opinions as extreme opinions, which are at least as likely to be wrong as the most strange or the least popular opinions. What liberal education was meant to be was a liberation from vulgarity. And the Greeks had a beautiful word for vulgarity. They called it aparakalia, lack of experience in things beautiful. Liberal education used to supply us with experience in things beautiful. It now provides us experience in things most ugly. We'll be right back.